This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through his series on the Sermon on the Mount. Here's Pastor Sandy with his message entitled, Jesus Culture.
And then blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. The world we live in advertises itself as one big party. Party hardy, man. It's always party time. Good times, lots of laughs, eat, drink, be merry. Isn't this the recipe for happiness? Jesus says, no. The truly blessed person is the man or the woman who's willing to mourn when need be, who can be moved by another person's sorrows. This is the person who recognizes a time for tears. I mean, when there's sin within and there's sin around, how can our eyes stay dry if we truly grasp the consequences of sin? Once it was a zookeeper's elephant that died. He was sitting under a tree sobbing. A bystander commented, my, how he loved that elephant. The boss kind of laughed and said, you got to be kidding. He has the job of digging its grave. See, there are all kinds of reasons in life to mourn. We grieve over pain and loss. We mourn uncaused circumstances. We cry over regrets and failures. 2 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 10 even mentions what it calls godly sorrow and worldly sorrow. Worldly sorrow, that's regret over getting caught. That's remorse that I now have to endure the consequences of my sin. But a godly sorrow, this grieves over the hurt that I've caused God and others. It causes me to desire to turn from my sin. It produces repentance. You see, a life with all jollies and no sorrow would make for such a superficial people. Hey, the happiest folks I know are those who haven't been insulated from hurt, but those who have found God in the midst of their hurt. I've heard it said, in order to realize the worth of the anchor, we need to experience first the stress of the storm. Remember at the tomb of Lazarus, even Jesus wept. Robert Browning Hamilton, he wrote a wonderful poem that reiterates this point. Listen closely. I walked a mile with pleasure. She chatted all the way, but left me none the wiser for all she had to say. I walked a mile with sorrow, and never a word said she. But oh, the things I learned from her when sorrow walked with me. You see, the first step in fixing what's broken in this world and what's broken in me is realizing that it's broke. Jesus comforts the person who stops pretending that all is well and mourns over the issues that grieve the Lord. Well, the third beatitude is in verse 5. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Here's a definition for you. Meekness is strength under restraint. Strength under restraint. It's choosing to hold myself back when it's within my power to act. A meek person remains under control. When it comes to meekness, think of cologne. We once had a guy on the worship team, and he wore this stinky cologne. And he wore it so heavy that as soon as you walked in the doors back there, you could smell it. It was awful. You see, cologne needs to be worn in the right dosage, does it not? If it's too strong, it turns people off. And so it is when a person comes across too forceful. He intimidates rather than invites. The meek person knows just the right dose of how to come across. Once my son Zach, he was playing shortstop on his little league team. A weak hitter who never was on base. He was up to bat. He hit a grounder to Zach. Usually, my son would make the play, but this time, uncharacteristically, Zach airmailed his throw over the head of the first baseman. I was just about to jump on him when all of a sudden Zach winked at me and he whispered, Dad, I just wanted the kid to get on base so he could feel good for a change. That's meekness. It's not always having to be right or be best. A meek man knows that it's better to win your respect than it is to win the game. That souls are more important than the score. It's the ability to set aside a win for me to achieve a greater godly goal. And God trusts authority to people with this kind of priority. Notice what he says, the meek, they inherit the earth. The Athenian philosopher Pericles, he summed up the world of his day. Fishes in the sea as men do on the land, the great ones eat up the little ones. This is the way of man, is it not? Thankfully, this is not the way of Christ. Psalm 18, verse 35 says of God, your gentleness has made me great. You see, his zeal could eat us all up, but he seeks what's best for us, not what's easiest for him. Nowhere is God's meekness more pronounced, more evident than on the cross. There the Almighty kept his emotions, even his power in check, in order to die in our place and reconcile us to God. This is why one day the meek shall inherit the earth. And then verse 6, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. What's your driving passion? What is it that yanks your chain? I mean, life is full of stuff that creates a bloated feeling for a time. I mean, that's why we call it stuff. But it never slakes our deep down thirst. The human experience has been summed up as follows. We are born crying, live complaining, and die disappointed. We learn very early in life that a physical pleasure will never satisfy a spiritual hunger, and thus we're left longing. Realize the words that Jesus uses here, hunger, thirst, these are brutal words. These are strong, intense terms. You see, they don't hit us as hard, for few of us have really been hungry and thirsty. Oh, we work in the yard for a couple hours. We come and say, oh, I'm so thirsty. We're thirsty because we haven't had anything to drink in the last hour. But to the impoverished first century readers who first read these words and heard these words, these people woke up every day not knowing where their next meal would come from. They woke up every day knowing they were going to have to scavenger for food that day. To them, these words, hungry, thirsty, they were a punch in the gut. These were strong words. Jesus was saying that when a man becomes so thirsty that nothing else matters to him but quenching that need, not what it will cost him, not maintaining his pride, not protecting his dignity, but when a thirsty person becomes desperate enough to look to Jesus, then they shall be filled. This was Jesus' promise. He promises satisfaction, fulfillment to those who hunger and thirst for him and what he says is right. I love the old saying, Jesus is the only permanently interesting thing you will ever find. He never grows old. He never gets stale. His mercies are new every morning. In one of his hymns, Charles Wesley penned, you, O Lord, are all I want. More than all, in you I find. Hey, don't ever mistake the smug, self-satisfied person is happy. He might be masking it on the outside, but inside, he's empty. No, real happiness comes from admitting that we're thirsty, that we're hungry, that we're desperate for Jesus Christ. And then verse 7 tells us, blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Once there was a soldier, he was brought to Napoleon for his second act of treason. The boy's mother intervened. She asked the general to show her son mercy. Napoleon replied, but your son doesn't deserve mercy. The mother answered, sire, it would not be mercy if he deserved it, and mercy is all that I ask. The general replied, well then, it's mercy you will receive. I'm sure you've heard the adage, justice is getting what we do deserve, grace is getting what we don't deserve, whereas mercy is not getting what we do deserve. And apart from God's mercy, heaven is out of reach for each one of us. This is why we need to be merciful. Can I deny you my mercy if I expect God to be merciful to me? Jesus says, the more mercy I show, the more mercy I'll know. This is why we need to bury the hatchet between each other. We need to cut our brother some slack. We need to show mercy today. Tomorrow, we might need some. Reminds me of the sign that hung on the wall outside the Catholic convent. It read, absolutely no trespassing. Violators will be persecuted to the full extent of the law. And then the message was signed, the Sisters of Mercy. It's one thing to talk about mercy, but real mercy is quick to demonstrate itself. 1 John 3, verse 17 asks, whoever has this world's goods and sees his brother in need and shuts up his heart from him, how does the love of God abide in him? You see, happy, happy, happy is the man who isn't stingy in extending mercy to others. God will be merciful to that man. And then verse 8, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Now let me explain to you this way. A cup of coffee can be too strong, or it can be a little too weak, and I'll still drink it. I've got no problem with that. But if I find a fly in my cup of coffee, that's a different thing. Suddenly that cup of coffee is intolerable. And likewise, my love for God, it's sometimes stronger, it's sometimes weaker, but it should always be sincere. Hypocrisy becomes the fly in the cup. Jesus desires genuine faith. This is why he tells us only the pure in heart, only the pure in heart will see God. You see, the Pharisees, they tried to be pure on the outside. They constructed thousands of laws regulating every aspect of Jewish life. They thought stringent obedience to the rules could make them pure. But Jesus disagreed. God cares about purity of heart, not just purity of hands. The Jews cleaned up and polished up the outside of the cup, but inwardly their hearts were wicked. Jesus came teaching, it's the pure in heart. Those are the ones who will see God. In the Old Testament, the prophet Samuel, he said to King Saul, for rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. In God's eyes, the sin lurking in your heart is just as evil as the brazen, ostentatious sin. A person's actions are his fruits, but his desires are the root. And the root is as much to God as the fruit. When God promised Jeremiah a new covenant, he said, I will put my laws in their minds and I will write it on their hearts. In Christ, we receive this covenant. God promises to clean up the inner person for us. He makes our desires his desires. It's a miracle, really. Dirty people become pure in heart. He puts his law in our hearts and on our minds. I like how J.B. Phillips renders verse 8. He says, blessed are the utterly sincere. The fountain of God from which we drink emits a pure stream. Sincere believers are those who see God. And then look at the beatitude in verse 9. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. Peacemakers. These are the people who ease the tension in the room rather than inflame it. These are the people who work on the solution rather than reiterate the problem. These are the ones who lower their voice rather than raise it. These are the people who put off more light than they do heat. Oh, we live in a dog-eat-dog world, don't we? I slap you, and you go home and you slap your kids, and then they take out their frustrations on their friends at school the next day, retaliate against their parents at home that when they get home. And this is how the world goes around. There's a ripple effect of angst and anger rumbling through society. And yet, I like to think of the Christians as shock absorbers. One guy slaps another guy who slaps another guy who slaps a Christian guy. And all of a sudden, a miracle occurs. That Christian absorbs the slap and turns the other cheek and returns good for evil and love for hatred. all of a sudden the ripple stops. He or she takes a little of the anger out of the pot and interjects some grace. The peacemaker makes the world a better place. He takes the stones that people are throwing back and forth at each other, and rather than throw them back, he uses them to build a bridge. This is the peacemaker. You could say that a peacemaker likes to fight. He confronts hostility. He assaults misunderstanding. She attacks problems with solutions. They make war for peace. See, a peacemaker sets out to destroy his enemy by turning him into a friend. And never are we more like God than when we seek to make peace. This is why verse 9, Jesus calls the peacemakers sons of God. And then verses 10 through 12, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. For so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Jesus warns us that when we take a stand for what's right or for his sake, those in the wrong will shoot back at us. Persecution will follow the Christian. And yet when you're under fire, remember you're in good company. For it has happened to godly people before. He says, even the prophets, the folks this world calls chumps, God calls champs. Jesus tells the persecuted, rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven. I like what A.W. Pink writes. He says, it's a strong proof of human depravity that man's curse and Christ's blessing meet on the same person. In other words, who God adores, man abhors. A faithful Christian is hated on earth, but a hero in heaven. How ironic. We have joined the hated heroes. One day our scars will be swapped for medals. The eighth beatitude warns us that sometimes we're persecuted for righteousness' sake. Just take a stand for what's right these days. Traditional marriage, or the life of the unborn, or decency in the media, or morality in the workplace, and you'll be persecuted by some people just for standing up for what's right. Reminds me of the man who died. He went to heaven. The angel at the gate asked him what righteous deeds had he done on earth. He replied, he said, well, once I tried to help out this little old lady. He said, well, great, tell me about it. He said, well, I saw this biker, this Hell's Angels type, this real bully. I mean, he was beating up this little old lady, and so I stepped in. I kicked the guy in the shins, told the woman to run for help. I even tried to punch the biker in the nose. The angel was so impressed by his act of bravery, he said, what a courageous act. How long ago did this incident occur? The man answered, about 2 minutes ago. At times we suffer for righteousness for no other reason than just trying to do good. At other times, Jesus warns us that opposition will raise its ugly head whenever we try to take a stand for his sake. Expect persecution when you stand up for Jesus. Hey, this world hated Jesus when he walked the planet. Remember, they crucified him. Don't think it's done an about face. One of the Roman poets described the early Christian community as, and I quote, the panting, huddling flock whose only crime was Christ. They were the object of scorn for no other reason than their loyalty to Jesus. Remember in John 16, verse 33, Jesus prepared us. He said, in the world you will have tribulation. He knew that this world would be a hostile, dangerous place for his followers. Here in verse 11, he tells us, blessed are you when they revile and persecute you. The word revile means to cast in one's teeth. In other words, they'll take a bite out of you. If you try to do right and stand up for me, expect cruel and vicious opposition. And then the word persecute, it means to pursue to the end, to hunt you down. They'll deliberately pick on you. They'll even seek you out for harm. Stand up for Jesus and what's right, and you'll become a target for spiteful treatment. And that's not the worst of it. They'll also say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. You'll be the object of rumors and lies and false innuendo. As a matter of fact, in Luke chapter 6, verse 26, Jesus tells us, "Woe to you when all men speak well of you." If everyone's being nice to you, that means there's something wrong with your witness. Hey, when you're persecuted for Jesus' sake, always remember his promise here in verse 12. "Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven." It's not enough that Jesus lets us know here that we'll be rewarded. No, he goes a step beyond that. He informs us that it's going to be a great reward. Now, I'm not sure what's going to make it great. But great is better than good, and good is certainly better than enough. And so just the word great, a great reward, should be cause for us to hang on just a little tighter, just a little longer. A great reward will be worth a few wounds and scars. In the preamble of the United States Constitution, our founding fathers guaranteed us the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But those founding fathers, they were wise old birds, weren't they? They knew that they could guarantee the pursuit of happiness, but finding it was another matter. Make happiness your only goal, and that's the best way to end up unhappy. Happiness is never the result of direct pursuit. Real happiness, the blessedness that Jesus speaks of, is a byproduct of living life his way. And the Beatitudes are a beautiful picture of this Jesus culture. I once heard of a bicycle race in India where the object of the race was exact opposite of most bicycle races that we're familiar with. The winner was the cyclist who traveled the shortest distance over a given time. Now check this out, the shortest distance. Everyone was on the starting line when the gun sounded. If a bike tipped over or if a rider let his foot touch the ground, he was disqualified. Thus, the cyclists all inched forward ever so slowly, moving just fast enough to maintain their balance. But imagine you. What if all of a sudden you joined the race, unaware of its unique rules? The gun sounds. You streak off from the starting line, pedaling as ferociously as you can, excited that you're creating such a distance between you and the rest of the pack. That's when you realize, man, I got it all backwards. You thought you were winning, but in reality, you're a loser. And this is what happens to the person who doesn't understand the Jesus culture, these eight Beatitudes. Don't be deceived. Don't get life backwards like the rest of the world has done. Happiness doesn't belong to the proud, but to the poor in spirit. Not to the merry, but to the mourners. Not to the manipulators, but to the meek. It's not the materialist who finds happiness, but it's those who are spiritually hungry. It's not the tough, but the merciful. Not the sneaky, but the sincere. Not the rebel rouser, but the shock absorber. It's not the celebrities who end up happy. It's the persecuted. Hey, blessed is the person who gets it right, who lives the Jesus culture, who lives their life the way Jesus has told us.
That concludes the teaching portion of today's broadcast with Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel, Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Join us next time as Pastor Sandy continues teaching through the Sermon on the Mount. You can learn a great deal about Pastor Sandy by visiting our website. The web address is sandyadams.org. That's sandyadams.org. Simply click on the radio program option from the main menu. When you click on the radio program option at the website, you'll find today's message and many other messages from Pastor Sandy. You can download today's teaching, listen again, subscribe to the podcast, or browse the archive of messages. If you live in the Stone Mountain, Georgia area or will be passing through, you can get directions and times of the services. Again, the website for all this information is sandyadams.org. We love hearing how God's Word touches the lives of His followers. So please log on to sandyadams.org and click on the Contact Us link and send us a note about how today's message has encouraged you. Your feedback helps us tremendously. Once again, you've been listening to the Daily Bible Teaching Program of Pastor Sandy Adams. Please tune in next time as we continue through the Sermon on the Mount. That's next time on Sandy Adams Radio.